we totally went there. You know, we thought that blackout was the end. we were prepared for, you know, the upheaval of the world, right? But we prepared in a way that was inspired and influenced by being raised in a communal setting like that. What our nation went through and what Indigenous people more broadly went through was an apocalypse. You know, that is indisputable. You know, there's genocide imposed upon our people.
What would happen if it all came crashing down around us? If stores closed, the power went out, if we were cut off from everything and everyone except our neighbors? And how important are the stories we tell ourselves about these futures, should crisis actually arrive? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. This podcast is about radical change. In August of 2003, my guest today was sure that he was confronted with radical change when the power went out in multiple southeastern and midwestern states in the U.S. and in Ontario and Canada. Anishinaabe writer Wabgijig Rice and his brothers experienced the outage from their community in their First Nation territory near Georgian Bay. Decades later, Wab Rice wrote a fantastic novel, Moon of the Crested Snow, to explore what he learned that day, and the wisdom of enduring change that he's learned from his people's collective experience with the colonial Holocaust. Their end of the world, as he puts it. The day that I picked up Moon of the Crested Snow was the day I knew I had to ask Wab Rice to be a guest. When we had this conversation, I had just experienced a near miss with wildfire evacuation in Northern California. So I was keenly interested in how Wab thinks of crisis, change, and the power of story to help people connect with a better future. This interview is just as much a gift as the book is. So let's dig in. Okay, today we are diving into the world of speculative fiction with author Wabgijig Rice, an Anishinaabe writer and journalist from the Wasaksing First Nation near Parry Sound, Ontario in Canada. Wab's novel, Moon of the Crested Snow, is just fantastic. Rich and honest, it offers a tremendously tense and sobering exploration of a world when things fall apart and how people come eventually to put things back together in a new way. The novel is gripping and as full of angst and uncertainty as it is of love and optimism. He's currently working on a follow-up to the novel titled Moon of the Turning Leaves. Wab, thank you for this novel and thanks for joining me today.
Oh, Philip, thank you very much, Miigwech. I really appreciate your kind words about the novel and I appreciate the invitation to join you to chat today. Thank you.
Maybe we can start by talking about the power of story in general, because a good story is far more powerful and motivating and relatable than even the most carefully crafted science or messaging. One of the biggest obstacles, I think, to achieving the major changes and that we need to see to solve problems like climate change is that people can't envision what life is like on the other side. To me, that's where story comes in. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts on story and why you chose to tell this story now and in this way.
Well, I think it's probably the lived experience, the relatable moments in stories that really connect people across communities, across cultures, across generations, landscapes, and so on. You know, before we started recording, you had mentioned the threat of wildfire in Northern California, where you currently are. And, you know, we can watch the stories on the news, we can hear it on the radio, we can see the links being shared on social media and read the articles and so on. But I think until we really have someone in our personal radius who can relate what that exactly is to us, it doesn't really hit home as hard as, you know, it can through a stranger, right? So in that sense, personal storytelling, I think, carries immense weight. And that's really, you know, since time immemorial around the world is how people shared lessons, how history was relayed from generation to generation, and how important sort of morals were passed down, right? How mistakes weren't repeated, how, you know, people stayed safe and so on by, you know, relaying these personal allegories from person to person.
And so that's what you were trying to do with your book then.
So I think when it comes to Moon of the Crest of Snow specifically, there was a lot of that behind it. You know, from, I guess, my own lived experience growing up in a First Nation to understanding the end of the world for Indigenous people, which many Indigenous nations around the world have already survived, right? Mm-hmm. And those ideas and concepts and allegories came to me through the people around me. And that really was the foundation underneath this story that I created. And I guess sort of a more modern context. But what's there is, you know, the result of generations of sharing relatable experiences, you know, and, you know, to get specific about the genesis of Moon of the Crest of Snow, you know, it came from a blackout happening in August of 2003. There was a major power outage that impacted a big part of the eastern part of North America. And, you know, I witnessed that through my First Nation. You know, I was living in Toronto at the time, but I was home visiting that particular week. And what I saw was an entirely different response than, you know, the chaos that one would presume would unfold in a city, right? In my community, you know, my brothers and I, who I was with, we sort of made a plan. We decided what we would do and who we would go to and how we would help others. And it was kind of exciting to think, you know, because we totally went there. You know, we thought that blackout was the end. we were prepared for, you know, the upheaval of the world, right? But we prepared in a way that was inspired and influenced by being raised in a communal setting like that, you know? And I thought, you know, a lot of the dystopian / post-apocalyptic fiction I'd read up until that point in my life, you know, was more or less about one or two people just trying to survive and not about communities coming together. And that's sort of what I wanted to explore with Moon of the Crest of Snow, was just showing how a community with the lived experience of apocalypse already can, and that is in the process of picking up the pieces, can rely upon that lived experience to carry on and go forth.
Well, again, thank you for, you know, sharing story like this. I think of it as a gift, and particularly a gift that I'm grateful for myself.
Oh, Miigwech, thank you.
One of the things that really strikes me about the book, that in reflecting on it for this conversation, is that I remember reading the book and you very slowly but incrementally and constantly ramp up the tension. Like it's unrelenting. Every time you turn the page, it feels like there's another thing that just ticks that tension dial up a little bit more. And by the first half, you know, it was consuming. And it occurs to me now, you know, I'm thinking a lot about climate change and, you know, we have large scale global things happening, conversations about how not to, to solve the problem. But the urgency and anxiety and tension for people is building around climate change and feels sort of like it's ratcheting up in the same way. With a novel, with fiction, you can work through it. You know, you can see how people work through it, not, you know, kind of as a cautionary tale, but also kind of as a thought experiment or a, you know, if you get my meaning. And so what do you hope readers take from the experiences that they have the chance to see of the characters in your story?
Well, I want them to take, you know, a spectrum of ideas and experiences away from it. From, you know, the more extreme side, I want them to understand that the infrastructures that we're reliant upon are very fragile. You know, they won't last forever. We could easily lose electricity, telecommunications, and so on in a heartbeat. I guess on the more positive extreme side, what I want people to remember is prior to all these infrastructures, these modern luxuries that we've become very familiar with, the land sustains us around the world. Every single culture that and civilization that has existed on this planet was born out of a, you know, intense and reciprocal relationship with the land, you know. And what the community in Moon of the Crest of Snow comes to realize is the answer has been there all along. It's these traditional knowledges and exercises that help them survive once everything falls away. And I think that it was highlighted early on in the pandemic. I think a lot of people have forgotten about this, unfortunately, by now. But early on, you know, there were some supply chain issues with groceries and so on. And people, you know, panic bought up the aisles at the grocery stores. And I think a lot of people, especially in urban centers, started realizing just how reliant we are upon food coming into our communities from elsewhere. you know, on trucks and trains and so on. Mm-hmm. But in a place, especially here where I am in Sudbury in Northern Ontario, we're surrounded by, you know, very generous lands, you know, very generous environments that can feed us and care for us and heal us if we need it.
It's worth noting that Wabgijig is not overstating things here. Our global systems of supply and trade are extremely complicated and extremely fragile. In the first months of the pandemic, we saw trade stoppages that cascaded through our food systems. Toilet paper may have been what topped the news, but there were so many other effects as well. Truckloads of unsold potatoes went into landfills. Dairy was dumped down the drain. And we're still seeing ripples of this on the shelves, in food prices, and even in the shipping deadlock currently being experienced off the U.S. West Coast. But an interesting parallel with Wab's book is that while global systems faltered during the pandemic, all around the world we also saw people turning instead to their neighbors and communities. Take, for example, small-scale community-based fisheries. Direct marketing, use of social media, people feeding their neighborhoods. We saw this all happen all around the world when the seafood supply chain was disrupted. And today, many folks are trying to learn from what they did right so they don't just have to go back to the fragile system that we knew before. So as Wab said, building on our values and collective experiences is a critical way that we can prepare for an uncertain future. Now back to the interview.
And so sort of following up on that last question, there's an Indigenous settler tension that's also very present in the story. And is there something in particular that you want settler readers to take from this story, from this voyage into what really is not only a very realistic, but a very possible future? I mean, you said, you know, in 2003, the lights went out and you thought, well, this is it, you know, and I feel like we all sort of have this sort of insinuation that maybe we're really that close to everything falling apart. Is there something that you hope settler readers take from this story?
Yeah, for sure. It's those two things I mentioned, but also it's to realize that settler colonialism is ongoing. It is not over. We are not in a post-colonial world. There are impacts of assimilation, displacements, genocide ultimately that continue on. And with Moon of the Crested Snow, particularly with the character Justin Scott, you know, I meant for him to be an allegory for that ongoing settler colonialism. You know, you have this already displaced people in a community far away from their traditional homelands. And when everything collapses, you have them being at risk of being colonized and displaced once again. You know, a settler with exploitation in his objectives comes north to sort of impose his own rule and his will upon this community, you know. But it's not just that. It's not just that extreme example of potential chaos. It's just understanding that, you know, Indigenous children are still apprehended into the child welfare system at alarming rates. Life expectancy is way lower for Indigenous people. Like in my home community, there aren't any men in their 80s anymore. And that's a result of being displaced, of, you know, having the food sources taken away, being disconnected from the land, and, you know, the forbidding of culture and so on. And also the removal of children from the community and the severance of those intergenerational bonds. You know, all those things combined have just impacted quality of life for Indigenous people everywhere. And it's going to take a really long time for people to heal from that. It's going to take many, many more generations. And we're really just only beginning collectively at that point of healing right now.
Yeah, I saw footage just today on social media of the mounted police just sort of walking with authority onto unceded territory that had been blockaded. And it made me think of this interview and that character that as an aside, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book is that character, Justin Scott, he could have come across as a caricature, but he didn't. He was embarrassingly real to me when I read that story. And you know, the premise of this show, The Second Transition, you know, I think there's really interesting parallels with your book and the acts in your book, the story arc in your book. You know, the idea that I'm sort of pursuing or playing with this show is that there's this first transition where you know, that involves all the strife and the challenges and the uncertainties and the course correction, reconnection through all of that with who we are and our neighborhoods and our families and the natural world. That's the stuff of the majority of Moon of the Crested Snow. And then it ends, and no spoilers, I'm not going to spoil readers, but it ends with people literally and figuratively looking ahead to what's next. So sort of standing in the vocabulary that I'm trying to develop, standing at the threshold of the second transition. Mm-hmm. And so can you tell me a little bit about your thoughts on the changes that that we face as communities, as cultures, thinking about things like climate, biodiversity, wildfire, whatever it be, may be. What do you think we need to come to terms with is, in terms of radical and extensive change? You know, what happens in your book is radical and extensive. What do you think's out in front of us?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's going to take, you know, major events to really influence people to make that transition in a meaningful way. We're going to have to, regardless of what our personal intentions or hopes are. You know, we are going to have to eventually come together as a global community to reverse the changing climate, because the evidence is unmistakable. It's indisputable, right? Here in Northern Ontario, we're seeing fires burn from the spring right to the fall, you know, just leveling massive swaths of forest right across the region, you know, and we see the smoke blowing into our cities and people think, oh, that's, you know, it smells bad. That's unfortunate. But, you know, I don't think people are seeing how that could upset their day-to-day life just yet. But, you know, it's a hint of things to come, I believe. What I think back to, though, and this is what really informed Moon of the Crested Snow from an Anishinaabe perspective, was the underlying hope despite everything, you know? So what our nation went through and what Indigenous people more broadly went through was an apocalypse. You know, that is indisputable. You know, there's genocide imposed upon our people, you know. In the end, though, people still held on to those ideas and those identities that were being beaten out of them. And examples of that are, you know, children whispering to each other in their language behind the nun's back at residential school, hoping that one day they'd be able to speak their language together again with each other. Outside of residential schools, you know, you had people in communities holding forbidden ceremonies in the basements of their homes in the middle of the night, or in a lodge in the bush in the middle of the night. You know, it was illegal to be an Indian. It was illegal to hold ceremony as Indigenous people, as outlined by the federal government. But people still did those things regardless. You know, they didn't give up. They had hope that one day they would be able to make that transition into this modern realm. So many nations everywhere survived colonialism, survived upheaval, and pushed forward to create something new. And sometimes it sounds naive to be so hopeful, but I can't help that. And I don't apologize for that at the same time either. You know, like I wrote a book about the end of the world with the underlying theme of hope and renewal, you know, and I think that's really what's going to inspire my work or influence my work for the rest of my life.
Well, I appreciate it. And you know, you gave us a book that forces us to contend with the past, that forces us in so doing to contend with the future. And, you know, I'd be remiss, and I know I'm asking as much for myself as for the show, if I didn't ask you about the sequel. Can you tell us anything about it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I am deep into it now. My editor and I are doing some heavy lifting with the revisions. We are hoping it will be published next fall. Basically, the story picks up about a decade after the end of Moon of the Crested Snow. And you'll remember, if you've read Moon of the Crested Snow, this community originally lived on the north shore of Lake Huron / Georgian Bay and was displaced to far northern Ontario, which happened to a lot of communities in Canada after Canada was settled. So after a decade in the bush, they decide that they want to go south, A, to see what's left of the world and to see if, in fact, the world has ended, and B, to try to reconnect with their homelands on the north shore of Georgian Bay. They've spent all this time up there living with the lands, benefiting from it, but they realize, you know, they aren't upholding their responsibilities to the land as Anishinaabe by staying in one place, because traditionally Anishinaabe traveled around their landscape to, you know, follow the food source, you know, according to season and so on, to allow the land to replenish where it needed to, right? So without giving too much away about the first book, you will see some familiar characters. go out on this quest, a group of about six of them, and it just follows them on their journey to the South.
I can't wait to see it. And
thanks.
When it comes out, congratulations. I know.
Thank you.
It's a lot of work. And after the writing, it's also a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I have one final question for you. It's something that I ask in one way or another, one form or another, of a guest on the show. And that is, what is the most radical change you would like to see come to be in your lifetime?
Well, the biggest change I want to see from a Anishinaabe or even a more broader Indigenous perspective is the replenishing of language, the total revitalization of Indigenous languages, mm-hmm. of children being raised speaking their language fluently. And that is not my experience. You know, I was raised with a little bit of my language, but I am nowhere near a fluent speaker. I'm 42 years old now, and it's been sort of a journey throughout my entire adulthood to try to learn properly. But since I became a father, I have two little boys now. It takes on a greater weight. And I do want to see them grow up with more opportunities than I had to speak our language. What that's going to take, I think, is a widespread social acceptance of the responsibility of Canada to restore these languages, because Canada is responsible for taking these languages away, right? And it's going to cost a lot of money, you know, to establish immersion programs in basically every community, you know, not just on reserve communities, but in urban centers as well, where Indigenous people also inhabit and thrive. You know, we hear this term reconciliation get thrown around all the time. But to me, and this is just my own personal opinion, it doesn't mean anything unless languages are restored along with it. So I think that's one big change I want to see. I also just want to see people take the land around them more seriously. And I guess by extension, take climate change more seriously. And it's not until that the food starts to dwindle that I think people are going to really understand the importance of that. You know, and we talked earlier about the moments that are really going to catalyze things. It's going to be that, I think, unfortunately.
You know, the only thought that I'm left lingering with is I keep wondering and hoping maybe there's ways that we can get there without having to be forced by major, you know, by pandemics and by food shortages. And because it always seems to come back to, you know, the gravity of the status quo is such that, you know, it's sort of lulled to sleep in a warm bath of water, and it takes a, you have to have ice dumped on you before you do anything about it. I don't know what it takes to not have to wait for crisis to create change, but I want to keep that door cracked open.
I agree with you, you know, and it's about staying hopeful, you know. And but like the thing is, like, most people on this continent especially have it really good. Like, life is really good for people here, and they're very complacent. And that risk is maybe farther away than it needs to be for them to take things a little more seriously. And I guess we're placated, and I include myself in that, you know, on a daily basis. You know, I placate myself with what entertains me or what distracts me from the serious issues. And maybe that's a coping mechanism. Maybe that's a trauma response. Who knows? But yeah, I agree with you. I would like to think, hopefully it's not a major crisis that inspires and invokes these changes, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Wob, thank you so much again for joining me. This was a really fantastic conversation, and I appreciate your time.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate the time you spent with my story and asking me these questions. It's a really important conversation, and I'm just honored to be a part of it.
Wobgeja Grice is the author of Moon of the Crested Snow, which is available wherever books are sold, and you should really check it out. It's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Miigwech, thank you.
This episode of the Second Transition Podcast was produced on the traditional lands and territories of the Washoe people in what is now known as Northeastern California. Funding for this podcast comes in part from the Earle Food Institute, from the University of Guelph, and from Voice Ed Radio. My guest today was Wobgeja Grice, author of Moon in the Crested Snow. Thanks for joining us.